early toddlering.
Yeah.
6 years. 6 years. And you were with two. So she's had two other jobs in that meantime. Always recruited, by the way, just so you know. Sarah has helped us with many a budget. She's helped us with moving forward on inclusionary housing. She's helped us with working on the Portland housing bond and working on construction excise tax, some of the seminal programs we have today that have helped create the Bureau. I'm sure she probably would like to disacknowledge some of those, but she did indeed help us with that. And we are all really terribly sad to see her go. She asked for the Blue Star Donuts. She got them. So 6 years of service, and you get a free donut
and some lovely flowers.
So I also know that Mr. Cupid Alexander, on behalf of his boss, my boss, everyone who's employed at the Housing Bureau's boss, wanted to say a couple of words as well.
Thank you, Shannon. So when the mayor was informed of this, he was like, it's been that long? Wow. So he wanted to say thank you for your service, for your commitment to PHB, for helping direct the city and where it needs to go. So we wanted to thank you. Sorry you couldn't be here, but we really appreciate your service.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Shannon, and please say thank you to the mayor for me. It's been an honor. It really has. It's been a privilege, and I feel like PHB, in the time I've been here, has really grown from a nascent bureau into, you know, a force with a budget that's nearly doubled where we started, and, you know, doing really good work in a city that really is experiencing a lot of change and growth and some challenges, but the direction that the Bureau is headed, the way that the city's taking a thoughtful approach toward continuing to grow our affordable housing supply and think about how we're serving those in need is something that I'm really proud of. And I feel like, you know, as a Portlander, as a developer, and as someone who really cares about the work here, we should all be really proud as a city that we are taking it as seriously as we do and that we're putting the resources that we need to into housing and that we continue to advocate for the folks who often can't advocate for themselves. So thank you for letting me be part of it. I know you'll continue to do great work with Shannon and the rest of the Bureau. The staff has been amazing in 6 years. I really am just so impressed with the caliber and quality and the dedication of the folks who work here at the Bureau. So it's been an honor, and I really look forward to continuing to engage with the Bureau, both in my professional life and also as someone who really cares about the city. So thank you very much.
And you can take that picture.
Thank you, Sarah. So we'll go into a little bit of the director's update for the month. I will say, with planning with thinking about the PHAC meeting before the 3-day weekend, it was hard to think of everything that we've already accomplished this summer and this August, but I want to give you a little preview of what we are doing this month. This morning, we actually joined the Bureau of Transportation and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability for a council work session on the prelude for the Southwest Corridor Light Rail Line and Southwest Corridor Equitable Housing Strategy. We'll be bringing council action items back to them in the month of October, both from adopting the Southwest Equitable Housing Strategy, which you've seen at this group before, as well as council will be asked to take action on the preferred alternative light rail line, which right now is slated to go down Barber Boulevard. With 7 stops in the city of Portland and 4 stops not in the city of Portland, Integrity, Tualatin. So the majority will be in the city of Portland, and our task in front of us is how do we plan for future transit-oriented development as well as prepare to mitigate the what we know will be impending displacement that already is displacing a lot of low-income renters in Southwest Corridor. So that was the first item council heard this morning on their work session agenda.
Question about that. So did they adopt the joint strategy from Tiger in Portland. Did they modify it? Did they accentuate any of the particular strategies? What was the context of that?
So this morning's session was a work session, which is differentiated from a council hearing. At a work session, right. They don't take official action, okay. But they are able to dialogue and discuss right. with usually members of the various bureaus about a particular topic. So the majority of discussion was actually, or the majority of the presentation, I should say, was devoted to the light rail portion okay. Of the project, and then some discussion of the equitable housing strategy. I think different commissioners shared a variety of different concerns. Some were echoed largely by most of the commissioners. Making sure that housing remains at the forefront of these discussions, not just the tail end. Wondering about some of the goals and the strategy overall and what may change if the light rail line doesn't go forward. One of the emphasis for us was making sure that we secure the rights to land for the development of the light rail line, which we are having discussions currently with TriMet regarding a memorandum of understanding, and we hope to reach a positive resolution by the time we go to council with the equitable strategy on October 4th. So yeah, they have not amended it. I will be frank with you that I did amend some of the goals, I should say not goals, but what we can do with our current resources. We had some early discussion drafts that said we could achieve 500 units on the corridor with existing resources. And in digging deeper into some of our numbers, it was clear that wasn't going to be a possibility. So I'm recommending that number is 300 to 350, but it doesn't mean we're changing our overarching goals. It just means what I believe we are capable with existing resources. To do what's called for in the corridor is going to require new resources. It cannot be something that we're doing out of existing funds.
But it doesn't mm-hmm. preclude using... Mm-hmm.
Ramsey, can you use your microphone, sorry. Please, so everyone can hear?
Oh, yeah. It's up pretty loud. But it doesn't preclude using either or both of the bond funds, right? There's no prohibition on that.
No, but there are yeah. geographical equity concerns that were right. put in the bond framework. And right at the present moment, I'd estimate 50 to maybe 100 units with bond funds in Southwest on the corridor.
Okay.
And that's just based on what we're seeing overall. Right. And then, of course, if Metro bond does pass, they're very interested in transit-oriented development, right. but they don't have a specific geographic target yet.
Thanks.
Next week, we'll be bringing another work session to City Council, which I realized I don't know if we have on your general updates or not. My apologies, but there's a supportive housing joint City-County work session with the County Commissioners and City Council to bring back the report that they called for last October about a plan regarding supportive housing. So that's September 11th. We also have some more administrative items coming to council, a IGA with the, as you can see from the director's update, I won't go through each one of these necessarily. Of note is Commissioner Udaly's renter protections, which are slated to go to council on September 19th. A final draft of those has not yet been released by Commissioner Udaly's office. And then the item that we had some discussion about at PHAC, I believe we had it two meetings over the course of the early, probably May and June,
mm-hmm. yep.
Regarding revising the terms of repayment for the down payment assistance loan citywide. So that if a family has resided in their home after 30 years, that loan would be forgiven with forgiveness starting at year 15. And then I think you can see some general updates. Oh, the joint session is down there on the supportive housing. And then I think you can see a few other general updates that we have this month. I also, tomorrow we will be talking with the city council about the Lentz collaborative work that's been occurring in the floodplain. And it's just a culmination of cross-bureau work. As you may or may not be aware, the Bureau had a short-term pilot project for reducing flood insurance rates in the floodplain, which in the last 2 years has been an enormous success. And it was part of our work for the Bureau. So that is generally kind of my updates to you. I don't know if you had other specific questions.
I have a question. I'm curious, I know that Beach of Tomorrow is about to open, and I know that that's a large project implementing the preference policy. And I'm wondering, and I know Maxine's not here, so she can't update us, but if anyone knows how that's going in terms of pre-leasing, if that's just, and it's a big test, right, for the preference policy, and if you have any feedback on that to date.
It is all of those things, and it is a work in progress, and I'd be happy to talk with you a little bit more after the after the meeting as to how that's going.
I would just also note that the Charlotte Rutherford is almost identified all of the applicants from the preference policy list as well. So the Charlotte B. Rutherford, I think this is less well known. It's the Central Cities project in North and Northeast Portland is also pulled from the preference policy list. So for folks that aren't familiar, we worked with Cascadia Behavioral Health to lease up the Garlington in, I guess, January, February of this year. And they leased up 31 units with the preference policy, and that went successfully well. The Charlotte B. Rutherford is a little bit further along than Beach of Tomorrow, and they're very close to having identified all of their prospective tenants from the preference policy list, and then Shannon's comments on the Beach of Tomorrow, so going well.
So just to give you some context, in this round, we did do applications for almost 3 weeks in February at a variety of different locations throughout Portland, notably a lot of the public libraries. And I should say not just Portland, but we've been asked and done work specifically in East County at other libraries to make sure that we're reaching everyone we can reach. We had over 1,500 applicants under the preference policy. Now, of course, they're then randomized based on their preference point scale, but the actual outreach and work that was done has been really amazing, and we're hopeful for both a great lease up at the Charlotte Rutherford and Beatrice Moore.
Shannon, is that a one time only, or are those dedicated?
Dedicated.
Okay. In other words, so many leads that they can.
So, quick question, Shannon. I guess I'm just curious on maybe a quick update on the Bond Accountability Committee and then the North Northeast Oversight Committee, and just if there's anything latest and greatest out of those groups.
So the North and Northeast Oversight Committee is meeting next Thursday evening. We'll be doing a discussion of some of the project updates, as well as updating on the home watershed projects that have been moving forward. And we haven't had a meeting with them since, I think it was July, when we had both the North and Northeast Oversight Committee meeting and then a joint meeting of Prosper CDI and the Housing Bureau's North and Northeast Oversight Committee. We'll also be presenting them with some detailed information in response to questions that were raised regarding the expansion and increase of maximum indebtedness in the ICURA, the Interstate Corridor Urban Renewal Area. As you may know, Nate, we have been talking with the community about whether or not there's an interest in increasing our ability to do work in North and Northeast through an expansion of the URA. Which we have targeted for new projects that would go forward potentially if we do the expansion. The Bond Oversight Committee typically meets quarterly, and though they have been very lovely to us when we need to pull them together sooner than that, And we'll be talking with them in October about specifically about where we are with the Ellington and demographic data, and also bringing to them some policies regarding how do we propose to deal with over-income tenants at the time of acquisition, and tenants whose incomes rise at the buildings that we purchase with the bond, so that we have policies in place that we would then necessitate us going to City Council, because the bond does allow us to have, with council approval, certain reasons where someone over 60% MFI could remain in the building. So we'll be bringing that following, hopefully, their comments and later this year to City Council. I don't know, in terms of, are you more worried, is there a specific question about either of those?
I guess more wanting to have those as regular updates, maybe just for the group, because I know we've talked in the past about just the synergies happening at these different other committees. And I get calls sometimes about, hey, what are you seeing from your PHAC? From your PHAC hat, and are these things, you know, unnamed right now, but are these things happening or not happening? And I'd love to be a champion out there to discuss things that might percolate for this group as well as others.
Okay.
And just knowing some of that feedback on what they're seeing and if they're liking what you guys are doing or not, you know, just those kind of things, so that I can speak to some of the community folks I work with a little bit more intelligently about where the Housing Bureau is with a broader swath.
Well, Nate, we've been talking about that internally as we look at filling the positions for PHAC as well, about you know, we've somewhat not had people representing on the various different groups, you know, to make sure that we have different voices. But as we are growing as an organization and we now have a variety of different oversight committees, we realize that the synergies may not be there between the groups. And so we're talking with the mayor about actually starting to maybe potentially have some representation on this body, so that you could not only hear from us about what the other bodies are thinking, but what the other bodies are actually thinking for themselves. So, Matthew is giving me a couple of notes, which I think he is trying to get me to interpret, but I'm just going to put it over to, I'm going to give it actually over to Matt to update you.
So just two other updates. I know that, I can't remember when, February or March, the mayor's office had asked the Housing Bureau to develop a incenting the pipeline proposal to use the property tax exemption program to try and incentivize some of the vested projects that came in for the inclusionary housing requirement to opt into some amount of affordability. And City Council passed that in early spring, and the Board of County Commissioners has had that on their work plan. And my understanding is that they are going to adopt the proposal with, I think, one modification to it, and then have that come back to City Council for ratification, so that a program can be in place as potentially as early as this month, maybe next month, depending on the timeline. So I just wanted to give an update on that.
Matt, on that program, isn't it time really sensitive, because now the project has started?
Yeah.
And not like you're under enough pressure already, but I knew that I didn't realize Multnomah County needed to weigh in on that one. Oh, because it's
tax exempt,
right? Okay, so yeah, of course. Mm. So do we still have an opportunity to really grab some of the projects that might be pending and
sure.
under, right?
I think this is how I'll answer that question. So on February 1st, 2017, there were about 20,000 units vested. When and BPS has done two updates since then, and the Bureau will be taking over the updates moving forward. But in August, September of 2017, that number had dropped to 14,000. The other six had either moved through or had left for some other reason. And then in another update in February of this year, end of January being in February, it had dropped to 10,000. So we're looking at the numbers to try and determine for the next update, which will be published sometime in the next month, what that vested queue actually looks like. But yes, we are seeing a number of projects either move through to permitting or fall out of the process for some other reason, and thus the number of projects that would be able to take advantage of the program has been declining for some months now. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the other piece that you all may hear about this month is that the Housing Bureau has been working with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability on the Inclusionary Housing Program to start a legislative process to extend the inclusion rate, the current inclusion rate in the mixed-use zones for an additional 2 years. So for folks that remember, we had built in a ramp-up after 2 years in the mixed-use zones, and given the success we're seeing in the mixed-use zones, and given that we still need more time to really analyze the program with some of the distortions that happened in the market with the 20,000 units, we're going to extend that inclusion rate for another 2 years before the ramp-up occurs. So you will, that legislative process will officially start in October, so we'll have more discussions in October, but some of the state-required notifications around land use and zoning changes will go out, so you all may hear about that, but there'll be more to come and more discussion in the fall.
Matt, let's make sure that that's on the agenda for Oregon Housing Alliance.
Sure.
In support, because we've got a pretty comprehensive agenda already, but I think that's one thing we'd really like to weigh in on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
awesome.
One quick follow-up question. Do we have a timeline yet for a residential infill and or better by design? And just ballpark, I mean, spring, summer?
Well, Ramsey, to clarify, spring or summer for adoption through City Council?
Yeah.
Or, oh.
That's
a complicated question. At least what I can say is that the Planning and Sustainability Commission has kind of intentionally been pushing residential infill back a little bit because there are things, they've also added work sessions for residential infill because there are certain elements of RIP and Better Housing by Design that are very similar. Mm-hmm. And so they dug deep when it came to RIP. And so they don't have to revisit quite as extensively some of those issues the next time around. But they did, since they are so similar, they really wanted those to move forward kind of around the same time.
Right.
So we have, from the last time I saw, I think there are 2 residential infill work sessions on the calendar through the new year, or through the rest of this year, rather. And then Better Housing by Design has a couple of a briefing, 2 work sessions, and the recommendation. Looking at getting those both done in December, at least as of today. That calendar changes almost weekly.
So. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments or questions for Shannon, or kind of looking at our next agenda item, which is open discussion, if there's any other items that commissioners would like to...
If I get you to jump in and just do one quick administrative, we just need to adopt the minutes.
Oh, yeah. Do we have a quorum?
I don't think we have a quorum.
With the number of people we're in the cast, though?
Hannah, yeah. We're missing Hannah, Maxine, and Ed. Oh, maybe
we have...
No, we're good.
Okay,
yeah,
we should
yep.
be good.
You guys are
good.
Yeah,
we
have
four.
Vote approval.
Okay,
I'll second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
All right, thank you very much.
Quick piece of,
yes.
tiny piece of good news. I normally wouldn't do this, but on the update sheet, we were awaiting word on Lyft, which is, again, an opportunity for us to kind of combine state and local funding, and we did get a positive recommendation to the Housing Stabilization Council for this Friday to fund the 5020 project at $1.6 million. And it is 51 units, not 48 on the report. So we'll be forward on that. We need to get more projects in the Portland area in the mix because we were the only ones in the Portland area, and the rest were all in rural.
In terms of homeownership
for Lyft. So we may need to coordinate some of our messages to, if they changed one or two important kind of components with the rulemaking administrative oversight, like they've made it non-permissible to start construction on the project until after the Lyft funds were accepted. And for projects where they're brand new units, but the construction's already begun, those were eliminated in consideration. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, took out the two habitat projects that are also on this list that really could have benefited, because this money really helps bring the price points down for the MFIs we're really trying to target. So again, this is an opportunity for the city and state to kind of connect up and create a lot more synergy between the funding sources.
Great.
So one last quick question I should have probably asked is when Matthew was speaking, but kind of more for Cupid, Shannon, and Matthew. I'm nervous about saying that the inclusionary housing is successful, because, and the only reason why I say that is because I haven't seen any data that suggests that inclusionary housing is being successful across the board. So I guess I'm asking, is there some web presence that the Housing Bureau has already that maybe I just haven't seen that kind of gives you some data on the qualitative, quantitative success stories out there? Because I'd be curious to see, at least from when I was here, some of the property management groups and how they do outreach in the community. And it didn't seem like early on in the process that it was leading towards seeing minorities in these housing units, just from where they share, we're putting the marketing out. Maybe it's changed since then. I'd love to just hear more about it, see that a little bit more present maybe in some of these meetings, just because, again, maybe it is successful, but I don't quite see it all the time. And I just want to be knowledgeable about the outcomes and not just like the strategies.
So we're working on an updated report that's going to be a little bit more robust than some of the BPS memos that have really focused on the vested pipeline, on both what's happening with the vested pipeline and what's happening with the inclusionary units that have been permitted or are about to be permitted, as well as the market more broadly. But I think one thing we can also look at, because this is not in that analysis yet, is looking at for the units that are opening up, what information do we have about, exactly to your last question, about who's being made aware of those units and how are those units being advertised and who's getting into those units. I don't know that we'll get that one in the next couple of weeks, but and not a lot of the inclusionary units have opened yet because they've been going through the permitting and construction process, but we can look into that. But as far as the units themselves and the market, there'll be an updated report this month at some point that we'll share and we'll talk about in October. And then we'll definitely take a look at the, to the degree we can, how leasing and marketing is happening for the inclusionary units themselves.
And Nate, in the short term, we'll send you just a little bit of information. I'm looking at Dory Van Bockel, the Development Incentive Teams Manager, who can send you some specific info just about a couple of the number of units in the pipeline and what we know we've already got moving forward. So.
If we did have a kind of a layout of a format that showed that, so
yes,
just updating that.
So that's what I was saying. Right? Something dives in just a little deeper. Right. Mm-hmm. That did give us a high level.
But the question about who's renting up the units,
yes,
as they become available is a whole other question.
Another, yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Affordability, right. Mm-hmm.
Is there any update on how we're going to move forward with filling the vacant seats on this commission? That, and then also the process from the whatever ONI is called now for the new guidance they're giving us about how we work.
I mean, I can take the second part, but.
We're talking with the mayor's office currently about PIAC, and I think what I just kind of mentioned to you was a little bit about that, about looking at the other bodies to make sure that we have full representation, but that we'll be continuing conversations with the mayor right now. So, and then I think Jesse can answer the Office of Community and Civic Life. Mm-hmm. They would like to just be called Civic Life, if you forget, and not used as an acronym. And they would also like us never to use ONI, but so please try to remember
Civic Life.
Very, very specific.
So Civic Life. The short answer is no. After our last meeting, I did send out an email to the two project managers. I did hear back, but just briefly stating that basically they weren't ready, and they didn't have the things that we needed. So after sort of speaking with Shannon about that piece, needing to fill some seats, what does PHAC look like? They have begun their discussions with the mayor's office. So.
As a quick follow-up, Sarah's leading us. What about leadership?
Oh, yeah.
Positions. Who's going to facilitate next go round, for example?
So the selection of the chair and the executive committee is done by the commissioner's office or the mayor's office. So we'll be in conversations with them. As far as timing goes, I don't know. We don't have a chair. It'll probably be a staff member that facilitates or another member of the executive committee, which I guess...
Is Shannon.
At this point, is Shannon. so we may just have a staff facilitating the next meeting, because it's still a question of the question of recruitment and how much do we want to bring on new members versus do we want to try and create overlap with our other commissions, and then the selection of the two other executive committee members and the chair. Do we do that at once? Do we sequence it differently? So. We'll have more answers by the October meeting. I think best case scenario is by the October meeting there is potentially a chair, or at least a temporary chair selected, and then we're moving on the process to fill the seats and get the body back to a full commission, which we almost had for a full year, but we'll get there eventually.
3 minutes left, maybe, but real quickly, maybe you covered this, but I don't think you did. The whole kerfuffle about screening criteria, I'm getting emails and letters about that. So does that have the last draft I saw was August 10th. I think you said there was a new one coming, or was that exemption from whatever it is that's coming up on your list? Where is it? Something about...
So, Ramsey, the council date right now is still slated for, as far as I know, September 19th.
Everything.
I'm sorry, 20th? It says 19th, but I think it's the 20th.
Okay.
And that is an item coming from, as far as I know,
right.
Commissioner Udaly's office,
right.
Which means she will finalize
okay.
a final draft.
Because this just talks about exemption for... affordable housing providers, but I didn't know.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. That actually is something different from mandatory relocation assistance.
Right.
When we...
So the whole thing is up.
This is something completely different, actually.
Right.
So
right.
Mandatory relocation assistance had
right.
an exemption for affordable housing providers, but it wasn't
right.
drafted with the intent that we wanted.
Right.
And so it's a very narrow exemption, and we're bringing that back to City Council. To change that exemption, to change the language regarding affordable housing.
Right, so it's the next day that the screening stuff would be up. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
On the 20th.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
And just real quick to your version question, I'll need to check and get back to you. There was a version that was out on the 10th,
yeah.
and there was another version, I think, that came out on the 18th, I believe.
Oh, okay.
So, both of those versions are still a transition from the
right.
old point system version,
right.
but I will make sure that you have a updated version.
Thanks.
And to add to this, there's a lot of communication going on with the Housing Oregon, Portland Metro Policy Council.
Right.
I think you might have been on the list
right.
to get
That's
the most, even the latest version. And then, and I must say that we know that not everyone agrees necessarily with some of the concerns and objections in the same way. But there's going to be a letter sent to City Council and the Bureau from Housing Oregon Policy Council on the whole topic of the challenging topic of screening.
You know, I don't know why, but we can't hear back here. So it doesn't.
Yeah, Housing Oregon is going to submit a position on screening. Looking about the screening
for screening the what? Getting into apartments.
Yes.
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 Okay. Yes. Okay. How about air pollution?
I think Diane's not a
different.
She's just
like,
yeah.
Okay. I don't know why I can hear Shannon.
Diane, I think you just need to pull your microphone
oh, yeah.
closer
to okay. your mouth.
Sorry. Yeah,
yeah.
Like pull it close.
Shannon's good.
Usually such a loud mouth. Okay, I'll be
back. Thanks.
Okay, I think we are ready to move on to our next agenda item, which is Dory giving us an update on the manufactured dwelling park proposal. Yeah. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Sarah, I like this.
A couple of folks here. All right, my name is Dory Van Bockel. I'm with our development incentives team as the program manager. And recently, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability moved forward legislation that was approved at council on the 22nd of August, establishing a new zoning designation for manufactured dwelling parks. As such, I don't know if you need a review on what that itself means. I was going to talk more specifically about the affordable housing component of that, but otherwise let me know. So a team of folks at the Housing Bureau has kind of convened to explore the ramifications or what would happen to build out a program in order to move forward part of the zoning code that established a density bonus for parks that are that have affordability at 60% of median family income up below for at least half of the units within each park. So that density bonus is significant. It would be a 50% density bonus that could either be taken on site or transferred to another site, citywide or outside of the Central City Plan District. However, in looking at that too, and trying to establish how many projects or sites might actually utilize the bonus, of the 56 manufactured dwelling parks with the new zoning designation, two of those are already seeking permits for redevelopment. 12 of the parks have less than 10 spaces that would be available to bonus or transfer. And so there are 9 parks that have over 100 spaces that may be able to benefit from that, with the intention of providing further incentive for owners to not try to take another path to redevelop the sites. So the Housing Bureau will be drafting code and administrative rules that will further go to council. And we're expecting for that to happen within the next 60 days. And some of the things that we're grappling with, frankly, are figuring out how to work with the different types of tenure within the different projects, as far as parks where units are owned or whether they're rented, maybe owned and rented to someone else, a variety of different things in order to establish the guidelines. So what we have been exploring is some possible criteria, and that would be to how we would be able to certify income for those spaces. We've found that it might be rather difficult without a lot of incentive from the actual residents themselves to provide that information, but it would be necessary for us to document that for at least those half of the occupants in order for the bonus to be granted. And we need to presumably require a rent roll for any of the spaces, both where space rent as well as unit rent were charged, and establish those rent levels. We've explored the possibility of having all of those units be, ensure registration with the city's rental registration system so that we're better able to track the inventory of who is living in parks and what they're being charged. And we have proposed that units could float within the park to allow for incomes rising in place or other reasons where it might be difficult to maintain the 50% percentage. Although there is a overall thought that the majority of people living in the parks are of low income status, we would still have to document that in some way. Initially,
the group is making a proposal of 99 years of affordability or perpetuity effectively to be consistent with other programs the Bureau is running. And right now we're, as far as how we would regulate the units with annual compliance similar to how other programs operate, and establishing a form of penalty in our regulatory documents, similarly to how the inclusionary housing program is administered. So that's the path we're moving forward with right now. Do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. This may be a Cameron question, so I'm sure you'll kick me, but I'm interested in sort of the 30,000 foot level. Some have been talking about that there's no guarantee of affordability in this ordinance. So if 9 out of 56 parks have, I think you said, potentially 100 lots or more, was that known at the time? In other words, that's if you got, you know, 25 of them that have 3 units, did somebody say, well, but we got, you know, 900 out of 1,500 total that'll be eligible for affordability? And I felt just a little late to ask that question, but I mean, I want to feel like we have a sense that there's a good opportunity that this density bonus will provide affordable units, because we got 900 possible units out of 1,500 or whatever it was. You know?
Yeah, I'm afraid I can't provide that confirmation. It wasn't something that the Housing Bureau was involved in directly, as far as the development of the affordable housing bonus on the table. So we are, frankly, coming to it after the fact to put together the administration of it.
Right, and so the thought process is that if you're at 8 or 9 or less, that's probably not going to be worth my time to even dig a hole. But if you have over 100, then at least there's an opportunity. Yeah. I could sell that bonus to somebody.
Correct.
Or do the work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Dory, were those numbers of potential transferable units, is that what exists already without accessing the bonus?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you did access the bonus, it's another 50% on top of that.
Right.
That could be transferred. Okay. Well, I'm really curious about how the transferable units are going to play out. I think it's a, you know, kind of interesting brand new market that doesn't exist. You know, who knows how much those are going to be worth? Who's going to want to buy them? But I think it would be worth the Bureau exploring if there's a almost like a broker role that could be played to help kind of keep track of any owners that have transferable units that could be made available for other projects in the city, other affordable projects or even market rate projects, in order to kind of incentivize the parks to take advantage of the affordability bonus.
Yeah, right now the Bureau of Development Services tracks the bonuses, and they're responsible for at least the transfer and recording of any of the documents. I don't think that there's the most robust of systems to, you know, database type wise doesn't really exist in that sense. So it's not something that we have a lot of information about, but it's certainly an interesting concept.
Mm-hmm. And then I would just encourage PHB to, before you get too far down the road of locking in the provisions of the rulemaking, to really bring in the nonprofits that manage affordable manufactured housing parks to see how this would work for them, or what stumbling blocks they might identify, as well as some of the developers that might want to purchase these transferable units, and make sure that this program is getting set up in a way that's actually going to facilitate those transactions.
Yeah, I think that we'll definitely need that partnership, because frankly the initial conversations we have had is that there are a lot of barriers to getting participation from the residents without a lot of motivation on their part to provide information. So it would definitely be something that we would need some community participation to make it successful.
Just a clarifying question. So I guess, what does it mean to be an owner of a mobile unit? Does that mean you have ground rights, or is that just your mobile home?
So the parks in these particular situations are all owned by one entity or partnership or however, but as one piece of land. And then the lots or spaces are either, the lots and spaces are rented, and then for each space, there could be a variety of different ways that people live in the units, whether they own an actual unit itself, a mobile home, or whether they're renting that from the owner also, or someone's renting from another owner, gotcha. Or purchasing either at least to own or actually have financing. I think a lot of them are, I don't have it right here at my fingertips, but the average park was built in 1970, and many of the units themselves are quite old. So a lot of them are owned outright and don't carry a lot of value themselves.
But you can never own land, more or less.
There's ways for that to happen, but not in this particular. There's a cooperative purchase that could happen, and there are state laws surrounding how that would occur, but it's not addressed specifically within the zoning code.
So does the zoning code require for income certification, or does it just require that the rents be set at a level that would be affordable to a family at 60%?
The zoning code is pretty broad. It just indicated that affordability would be at 60% of area median income or below, and gives the Housing Bureau the responsibility for determining that.
Okay. So it's kind of the Bureau's discretion to, at this point, you're looking at requiring that the incomes would be certified, not just that the rents be set at that level.
Correct.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Dory.
Thank you.
Okay, next on the agenda is legislative update from Victoria. Hi, Victoria, welcome.
Hello. I'm Victoria James with the Portland Housing Bureau policy team, and I will be giving just a short legislative update. So as you all know, ahead of the legislative sessions for both the federal level and the state level, the Office of Government Relations asks all the bureaus in the city to kind of flag for them our priority policies and just items generally. And in order to do that, the Portland Housing Bureau reaches out to both its staff internally, but also to external partners and all of our advisory bodies and committees. All that information comes back to us. We make issue sheets, which are kind of high-level overviews of what the item ask is. We send that to Director Callahan. She sends that to the mayor's office. Then it's routed to the Office of Government Relations, who then works with the attorneys to make the city agenda, and then council votes on it, and then the legislature takes up the issues that we push. So that's the sort of like 100-foot view of all the different things happening. That said, with the state legislative agenda, we are at the point where it is back at the Office of Government Relations. We forwarded them four different items. The first one was to support the creation of a just cause standard of eviction. For those of you that don't know, in the state of Oregon right now, landlords are allowed to evict tenants for no cause, and we would like them to be a little bit, we would like to specify circumstances under which we think it's acceptable to get rid of a tenant. We also are supporting the lifting of the preemption on rent stabilization. We feel like this would give us an additional tool to kind of get out of the housing emergency, hopefully. We also put forward extending the sunset of the multiple unit limited tax exemption. And as you know, that is kind of one of our cornerstone incentives for the inclusionary housing program, so it's pretty important that we don't let that just expire out. And lastly, we would like to increase transparency and fairness during transactions of properties at risk of flooding. Basically, what we're asking is for the seller's property disclosure statement to disclose flood risk and kind of give a better indication to the buyer of what the flooding insurance cost is going to be. Maybe that sounds kind of out of right field, but since 2016, the city has been involved with the Lead Stabilization and Job Creation Collaborative that was started by, I think, Kate Brown. And so that was one of the items that kind of came out of that collaborative. In addition to our major items, we also took positions of support on the Oregon Housing Community Services budget request for services to help, for publicly supportive housing developments. So part of the major cost of a publicly supportive housing unit is the services that go along with it. So OHCS has a budget proposal to kind of help bolster that. And as
permanent supportive housing?
Yes.
Permanent supportive.
Sorry, what did I say?
Publicly.
Sorry, that's permanently all. Supportive housing, yes.
Okay.
And lastly, we are supporting Prosper Portland's proposed amendments to urban renewal, which is ORS 457. Prosper Portland has been working with the Oregon Economic Development Association Urban Renewal Committee. They all have really lovely, nice, long names. So that group has been together, I believe, since 2009, and they basically look for ways to improve how we do urban renewal. The two main things that Prosper Portland is wanting to support in their potential legislative item is codifying some best practices around reporting urban renewal outcomes, and also detailing some more specific things under the consult and confer requirements. So that's basically how a entity talks to other taxing jurisdictions. So in our case, how Prosper Portland can talk to, let's say, Portland Public Schools about how the URA funds are being used. So that is the state legislative agenda. If we're looking at kind of timeline for the next couple of months, later this month, the city attorney's office should be completing their sort of citywide legislative draft. In October, the Office of Government Relations will be meeting with the various bureau executives to kind of review that draft. November, council will have a work session to look over that draft. And then in December, the final legislative agenda for the city goes to council. I believe the legislative session, which is a long session, starts a little bit early this year. It's starting on January the 22nd. So that's kind of what we're looking at for the next couple of months. Swapping over to the federal agenda, we are still at the point where we are collecting items. We are collecting items from external bodies and advisory commissions such as yourself until tomorrow. At which point then I get to sift through however many tens of hundreds of items folks have sent over to try to figure out what the intention behind those things are. I will say generally on our federal legislative agendas, we ask for increases to the community development block grant, home, public housing, VASH, Section 8, that whole sack of funding. And we generally support mental health, homelessness, and low-income housing efforts. And in the last couple of years, we've also asked Congress to please finalize spending decisions on time so that we can have access to those funds. And the timeline for the federal legislative agenda actually pretty much mirrors what we're looking at for the state. Again, in November, the council kind of takes the state and the federal work session kind of at the same time, and then in January we're looking at the federal session to start again, pending any craziness up there. So
that was what my comment was going to be, is are you guys seeing hopeful days ahead federally? Because I know this whole attack on sanctuary cities and defunding a lot of federal resources here, and then Shannon left, but there's a even more major project that's slated along Division, which is Todd Development with TriMed and House Bill 2017, and there's some discussion that it may not happen now, potentially, because all the money's not in place. And so I'm just wondering, is there a narrative that looks like there's a hopeful day ahead, or does it still look pretty grim?
I have not heard any sort of expressions of like sunshine coming up.
Say clouds.
It's looking pretty cloudy, but I've also not heard anything that, you know, is set in stone. Like, I haven't heard, like, this is the day they're going to start enforcing everything they've said about sanctuary cities. So, yeah.
And as far as the budget side goes, I think Mike can talk to that question about federal funding from his forecasting when he gets up here for his section.
So I just actually got the governor's proposed housing policy agenda at like 2 o'clock, which I haven't read, but until you got to the last item, I wondered whether how aggressive the city would be on resource asks. And I mean, there's a lot more than BSH, obviously, right? And I think I might know the answer that the city's a participant with the Housing Alliance, so I don't know whether the Housing Alliance takes the lead and the city does a Me Too, or whether the city is equally ambitious about resource asks. But it looks like the governor's going to do a few things around maybe homeless kids, and after the articles I've been reading today, we're worst in the country or something. You know, foster care, homeless kids, permanent affordable housing funding, probably some lottery bond increases. So the Housing Alliance is, you know, up to their knees on that. Mm-hmm. And is that the vehicle, and then the city just kind of comes in behind, or is the city, looks a lot of it substantive and not resource ask, I guess that's what I was reacting to. And aside from the PSH stuff, what happens with the dollar asks? Maybe you don't know that one, but it just hit me.
So, I mean, I'll say that we are a dues paying member of the Housing Alliance, right? So we tend to be in support of their agenda largely. Right. And as the sort of session rolls into place, there are far more things that we weigh in on than are on our main agenda too. So Matt, do you want to piggyback on that?
That's good.
No, I mean, you're right. The only thing I would add is because we're not a direct recipient of state funds, we tend to try and support the positions our partners take on funding, whether it's the county or community-based partners. Because our funds come from the city and the federal government. So to the extent that one of our partners brings it up at the Alliance table and it's an agenda item, we will support that.
Yeah, okay.
You touched on exactly what I was going to touch on. I really appreciate the city's presence at that table with us, because we're very much stronger all together. And I think it does make sense to, you know, prioritize those things that the city can make a big impact on.
Sure.
And also, I think things may emerge farther down the pike. And the one I, you know, just tag out there is, I know it's sensitive, but mortgage interest deduction, and whether or not that does end up being a real conversation. Because if, and maybe the increase of LIF funds both for rental and home ownership, because those are two areas that could prove to be incredibly valuable to the city for our housing agenda here. So appreciate that coordinated involvement.
One last thing. I was just going back, kind of like Ramsey. I remember the governor earlier this year talking in her 5-point address, I think it was around the state of Oregon address, her mentioning workforce housing. And I'm wondering, is that a thing now? I mean, in other cities, people kind of keeping up with the times, and now that our city's developing more hotels, more manufacturing, more tech, are we doing anything that feels like a little bit more synergy around workforce housing, or are we just doing what we always do?
Actually, can I chime in just a moment on that? Because I know that the governor's office has chosen 6 projects as pilot projects and invested quite a lot of money into those. We have one of them in the mix in a rural community in Lincoln County. So the question would be, can we find out techniques and ways and strategies where it really turns into very real housing for the workforce here in Portland and around the state,
and then kind of ride on that. So it might be a question of how well the pilot projects go in the first go round, but workforce housing is definitely on our agenda to be sure. And we'll have to see if some of them really fly and some of them fall flat and then follow up on that. Good point.
I don't have too much more to add to what my aunt said, yeah.
I think it's just something we want to make sure we keep track of.
Nate, I've always felt strongly about workforce housing as well, and I think one of the challenges the Bureau has always had is just the limitations on AMI levels for its most of its funding.
Gotcha.
So unless there's some new, you know, sort of funding source put forth that allows us to flex those dollars a little bit higher than 60 or 80% AMI, at least in Portland, it's been a challenge to get to that 80 to 120% MFI level on the rental side. So I would like to see something as well. I think that there's new funding sources that need to address that. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, everyone's favorite part of the meeting. Mike, welcome to the table. And Mike, before you get started, Stacy would like us all to get out our parking tickets if we need validation, please.
I'm all for validation.
Absolutely. I'll take validation any chance I can get it.
I couldn't wait to see you. Look, I know. You got me.
I got the land.
Okay.
Well, can't get cast chasing. Oh, there it is.
You're good to go.
All righty. So, it's September, so it must be budget season already.
Boy.
It's interesting because my staff just got done with year-end close a couple weeks ago. So, we often joke about budget's a year-round process, and you know, it really is in Portland. So, just to kind of go over where the Bureau's been, where it's going a little bit. So back when I started working for the city and had Jean Marie's job as BHCD's budget analyst, it was almost exclusively a federal funds budget, you know, 20-some million dollars. And then mid-2000s, some general funds started getting added to the mix to deal with homeless services. Then the merger happened. We had urban renewal funds in from Prosper Portland. So Nate came over to join us.
He brought the money.
And he brought the money. And then the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen an add of the construction excise tax, short-term rental funds, the housing bond, tremendous increase in general fund for homeless services. We've seen the TIF lift, in addition to just growth in urban renewal areas in general. And you can see that actually most of those stacks in that graph are about the size of what BHCD's budget was back in 2002-2003. Tax increment is still the biggest funding source. It's a finite funding source. Many of the URAs we're working in right now will have reached their maximum indebtedness. Now, of course, there's always the option for some of them to increase the maximum indebtedness, so that could happen. It's happened before. Various adjustments to urban renewal areas. Where we're seeing the biggest growth is with inclusionary housing, where we've got the construction excise tax and then obviously the housing capital fund, which includes the bond. Where we're starting to see some shrinkage though is in the housing investment fund, as some of the original loans from back in the 90s from the Housing Investment Fund start paying off, and then those that stream of income stops growing. So as some funding sources grow, others fade. I mentioned the federal resources. You'll see there that we're still, you know, pushing that, you know, $25-30 million range on that. But that's really been due to some growth in some of the other federal grant funds besides CDBG and Home. So where does the money go? Well, one thing that doesn't change is affordable rental housing is still the biggest piece of the pie. And it's become bigger as more resources have come into play. But another place I would point out where there's been actually a lot of growth is in home ownership. So we're pushing $20 million there when that funding was down in single digits. But between the additional down payment assistance, additional home repair, and the development of condominiums for low-income residents, that funding has grown quite a bit. Also, obviously, homeless services. I mentioned that really this growth started out with maybe $1 million or so that was going into the Housing Investment Fund. Actually, it was a little less than that. It was less than $1 million. And about $6 million at one time, it showed up in 2006. And this is what it's grown into in 12 years. Something new, renter services, it's a new space that the Bureau is getting into, so we're seeing a slice pop up there. I would point out one thing that, you know, even though that administration number looks, you know, wow, that's a big number, proportionally, that hasn't changed much. In fact, it's actually even gone down a little bit. So that's something the Bureau has really stayed on top of in terms of cost containment.
The staff in the back is acknowledging that.
I think we all weigh in on that one.
Can I ask about if you were already going to go there, Mike, the economic opportunity, would you remind us what that piece?
Sure. That's community development block grant money that goes to Prosper Portland, and they sent it to Work Systems, Inc., who has a series of subcontractors that they put money out there for, and this is for workforce development and also youth employment development. Over the last few years, we tried to get them to try to pair that up with folks that are in the homeless system, try to provide resources for employment for people. So, and that's been a pretty consistent level of funding for as long as I've been here, so about at least nine years. So, speaking of CDBG, great segue. So, like I said, federal grants years ago, this 15 years ago, it's been that long. This graph would have been flipped. This big piece here would have been federal funding, and this would have been local funding. But as you can see, it's the other way now. One thing that's interesting is the distribution of funding. Obviously, you know, rental development is still using most of it, but pretty program, as far as program delivery, everything is pretty much got an equal chunk of the pie with both home ownership and what goes to Prosper Portland and what goes to homeless services. And the staffing and indirect we charge off is an equal portion there. So really, what goes to our home consortium partners, which are Gresham and Multnomah County, and what goes to Fair Housing is another wedge in there. What's going on with federal grants? Well, you know, we thought we were going to see a big dial back on these grant funds, even to the point of them going away altogether. What Congress has done instead is they've increased the funding. So where we thought going to have to figure out how to backfill, you know, $7-8 million of CDBG and $3 million of home, we're actually getting additional funding. So we had the other issue is, oh, not only did we not get cut, it went up. So that's
the reason why. I mean, obviously we need it, but I mean, with all of that wounding, is there champion something?
Well, I think my understanding of what's gone on at the federal level is there are a lot of members of the House who, because their constituencies use CDBG for infrastructure, it's a pretty major underpinning of infrastructure budgets in parts of the country with certain political persuasion. And has benefited Portland because we use CDBG almost exclusively for housing or housing-related activities. So that's where it's benefited us. The home grant, I have no idea, because 5-6 years ago that grant was on life support due to some cities elsewhere in the country not getting the money spent. And all of a sudden, it's kind of getting a halo effect from CDBG, and it's maintaining its level of funding.
Right.
So, for the future, I don't know. I'm kind of just baffled right now what to do for 1920. I'll probably just go with a flat line and see what happens at this point.
Mike, before you transition to the timeline, I guess it's a sources and uses question. So the uses for the rental program, not development, but registry, inventory, whatever it is that fair to say, is that source for that general fund, or how is that whole new initiative getting funded?
Well, right now, initially starting up is general fund.
Okay.
The intent, once we get down the road and get the registration system in place and get synced up with business tax collections, the intent is that source will take over. Business tax is considered a general fund resource anyway, and I think the intent is that carve-off that goes to it's the landlord registration piece would come direct to the Bureau to fund these programs, and hopefully if it collects well enough, other learner services programs.
And so Airbnb runs into that too, probably, and then all the sort of undedicated.
So there's different pieces to the short-term rental
pie.
In fact, I was just confirming some things with OMF on that just before I came in here. So there's multiple pieces. There is about $936,000 of that's going to pay some debt service on a bond we did at the end of last year. It's another $300,000 annual income that's going to continue to grow over time that comes to the Bureau that we're actually using in support of the bond projects right now. It's a place to stage some costs before we move them.
Right.
And then we get one-time funds based on what's collected in the prior year. We don't have what the number is for 17 and 18 right now, but in 16 and 17, there was actually $1.7 million over and above the allocation we normally got that came in. So that's the initial piece of the Airbnb or short-term rental revenue. There is another portion that you may recall was the newer 2+, I guess it's referred to as 2+2. And we haven't seen the information yet on what those collections are going to be. So that's kind of the short-term rental piece of the pie. There's also always some form of litigation that's popping up around that with the
rental program. It's local revenue, local program.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so I think I'm not sure how the Revenue Bureau is funding some of the other programs around compliance on that. I think there's just general funds funding that, so.
Thanks.
Got a
follow-up question on the straight line comment you made. So what does that mean? Do you kind of roll forward doing what we're doing, or do we get?
Yeah, so let's just take CDBG and home, both of those for example. So with the change in administration, from what we were hearing, I took kind of a conservative approach and assumed that we'd see a 5% cut each of the next 3 years. And then found out that, everything stayed the same that year. Okay, well, let's make it 3% each of the next 3 years. okay, we got more money, the next two. So what I'm thinking is next for 1920 and beyond, looking at no rate of increase. So I would plug in the same number that we actually got for 1819 and for 1920. So that's what I mean by a flatline increase. I mean, at this point, I don't know what else to do. We've got, I mean, when I would look at things politically, I think then I should just zero them out. But that's not what's happening. So that's on the income side. And then what we do on the expense side is we try not to forward allocate too much. It's a difficult dance to do because you've got to forward allocate some of the monies because of the development timeline. And with CDBG, fortunately, we've got enough ongoing programming where we're doing loans, we're doing subrecipient contracts, the funds that go to Prosper Portland, that we're able to get money spent on a fairly regular basis. Where it gets to be tricky is with home, when we're having to both do the forward allocating and wait on the development timeline, is getting the money spent when it needs to get spent. So it's kind of a just a weird dance you've got to do between the expense side and the revenue side. When you don't know what's coming in on the revenue side, and you really don't know the timing of how the major expenses are going to happen. So sometimes with that much uncertainty, you're better off just trying to keep things stable and then adjust as you go along.
Well, certainly that sounds prudent on its face for sure. The question then becomes, what if more money comes through and then you guys grapple with...
That's why I'm the Bureau Director.
That's why I'm looking this way. That's exactly why.
So you go to
right, and then it's a question of, again, what's the strategic investments that could be made and what's the priorities, and I look forward to that conversation if we're able to help with that.
Okay, so timeline. This is the general timeline. I mean, so there we are on the top blue box. It's September. Guess what I'm working on? I'm working on the forecast. We're also doing the fall supplemental budget right now, and so that's really, you know, timing-wise when we update the forecast for and get a revised forecast in place for that. And that becomes the basis for the request budget. The only thing that's happening is where we would be in the early phases of the development of what type of funding requests would be happening. So that's, you know, a couple of months worth of that going on. In general, this is kind of what we've seen in past years. November, December, we're getting guidance, we're getting forecasts, we're starting to finalize those funding requests. We're talking to, you know, PHAC, other stakeholders, the mayor's office, kind of find out what direction we want to go with the request budget. And then January, I got the couch in my office now, so I got a place to sleep during January. It's getting the budget put together, and then February is when Jean Marie and the city budget office gets to look at all the work we've done and ask a lot of questions and do her analysis. And during this period, there's various, you know, citywide outreach activities going on for public input. So in general, that's what's happening, but budget process changes. So the mayor's office had a consultant in, and they came up with talking with folks and putting their best knowledge on the problem, came up with about a 17-page document about different thinking around the city budget process. So those are in the process of still getting distilled down into what a final budget process for this year will look like. I think CBO is trying to roll that out later this month. That's going to impact some of our internal timing. We will let you know that as soon as possible. We're always also trying to do some continuous improvement with our internal process. And Matthew's policy team come up with a process for moving their particular budget thoughts forward. Myself and a couple of the other managers liked it, and we decided to use it for the whole Bureau. And we'll probably try to work that in the same way. One thing we probably know for sure about the city's process, and Commissioner Lynn, you'll appreciate this, program offers. That'll be something new for a lot of bureaus. We haven't done it really formally in packages, but if you remember, I think you've all seen our PAC budget worksheet, which is pretty close to laying out what our base budget looks like, kind of in a programmatic manner. So that's something we've used for a number of years. It's, well, they're not program offers, they at least let you look at what's in the base budget at a fairly high level. So that'll now get down into, you know, more formal documents or documents, a little more detail about each, probably each box that you would have seen on that spreadsheet. So that's probably the one thing we know for sure. And I'll look back to Jane Marie and see if she's got anything to add. She's got nothing. So
she was nodding. She was not happy.
So I think Shannon's going to say a few words about PHAC's role. Take questions now, or you want to go ahead?
So last year, I know we were all rushing to do the budget process, and I know you all talked about not having enough time, so that's why we wanted to give you a little bit of an overview with what we know now in September. We had hoped we'd have a little bit more budget guidance at this point, but I think we should have it. I'm looking to Jane Marie for another head nod by our next PHAC in terms of timing, just so we can let the group know. Thank you, Jane Marie.
Hi, I think I know everyone, but I'm Jane Marie Ford with the Budget Office. So I think in terms of overall process guidance, we will have that by the end of September. That's, the Mayor's Office is working on that, but that's my understanding. We don't usually get more of the programmatic guidance or like the priorities guidance until a little bit later in the process, but we have some work sessions scheduled for that later in October.
So, and one of the things that I wanted to make sure we do this year is do a little more outreach to all of the various different advisory committees that work with the Bureau as we start to look at what our priorities are and what packages that the Housing Bureau may offer as additional packages this year or potential reprogramming. We wanted to get our committee's thoughts earlier in the process. And so we'll be looking to you next month to talk a little bit about what ideas or things you may see. Do you all remember that big budget book last year? Do you still have your budget book?
I don't know that everyone took theirs.
It's a public record if you wrote it in.
Yeah. So the only, oh, thank you, Matt. That was not the point of the. I just wanted to make sure that you may have eyes on that again. Would it be helpful for you to see what you were given last year? I know that, you know, it'll start moving rather rapidly, but for you to have a look at what you had last year to familiarize yourself with what you're going to see potentially changing this year with the multi-million dollar. I mean, I want to make sure you have time in advance to look at materials. Ramsey?
Yeah, it's been a bunch of years, but is there a document that you submit to execs, like a, you know, four pager or something that? No, nothing that condensed. Okay. Because I mean, it used to be
that predates both Shannon and I.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, I know. I'm as old as dirt. I know that. But I mean, isn't there some condensed document that would be 12 pages, maybe, or that's a little more palatable? Maybe not.
Yes, I think there is. I think it may be a little longer than 12 pages, but we can. Yeah. I think what would be helpful is to give you our budget document and what was our actual budget for this year, to familiarize yourself with what the kind of documents you're going to see and be able to have us answer some questions for you.
I think they adopted that. I think just got posted on the CBO website. It's even more condensed than our request and more showed what we actually got. So.
I think we can send that out after this meeting to all of our commissioners.
Yeah. That would be great. Shannon, I
attending pretty consistently. I'm going to be at a national conference the first week of October, and I'm just wondering, I know that people that can come and, you know, different mm-hmm. meetings can be here and can't be here. How do we, you know, what's a rational approach to some continuity with the conversation about it? I mean, can we maybe certainly preliminary conversation in October when hopefully a critical mass of the committee's here, and then pick it up again in November? Or
yes. Yes, it's not a one-time shot, but
okay.
Yes.
Right. Okay, sorry.
Google Cloud.
Yes.
And then I guess I've always appreciated, Mike, and you kind of alleviated to it, but the program offerings, I can remember it had to be about 3-4 years ago, and maybe we still use it somewhat, but where you could literally identify every program that the Housing Bureau funds and like what you're literally buying for that investment. And I remember us having those exercises. We had a lot more time than last year when we did it, but it proved out to be pretty effective where we could, as a group, kind of make some executive decisions, if you will, on things that we felt like could maybe lose a little bit of money and we would gain a little bit more in this other area. And I just thought that was very insightful, resourceful for everybody involved. And I'm just hoping that if there's some changes, that may not be one of them, or if there's process improvements and we haven't used that maybe that could implemented into this new process. So I guess I'm just wondering, is our role changing vastly different, or is it staying kind of the same? And I guess, what do we expect to look forward to?
No, I think your role is staying generally the same, with hopefully a little bit more advance notice than last year. Nate, who's some of the commissioners, is your first year with us, but last year was a little bit more condensed than we would have liked the process to be. But I think part of it is hearing your ideas early and then also looking at the specific allocations and giving us some guidance. We will bring you recommendations, though, so we're not expecting you to recreate or go through our budget, but if there are overarching themes as we talk to our commissioner in charge about priorities for this budget year, you know, typically council sets out, or the mayor sends out, 2 or 3, 4 overarching budget themes. I would be surprised if housing or homelessness was not still in some way, shape, or form in those priority areas.
So I won't be part of the process this year, but I do have just a couple observations for things that I think can help, especially for new commissioners. One is, you know, as we talk about how much money PHB ultimately sends to Multnomah County in support of Home for Everyone and the homelessness programs that they do, it's helpful to have someone come in from the county and talk about what that money is being used for. I think that's a nice context and something that the commission should be informed about. The second is just, I think, Mike, you do a pretty good job of this, but a kind of a reminder of, you know, what portion of this budget is actually coming from the city, which it really isn't very much, right? And when you think about the world of our funds and how, you know, they all intersect a lot with the city's view on what needs to be funded, right? From you know, especially on the rental housing development side. But really the influence piece of this, when we're talking about the city overall, is general fund and, you know, maybe a few other little one-time funds or other things. And so just as the commission looks at the budget and what levers they can pull, just remembering that the context is really the general fund piece and not, you know, the other things. I mean, they all tie together, but when you start having that conversation about moving priorities and programs really in the context of what the city budget actually looks at from PHB, it's relatively small, and that's just due to the changing nature of programs. But I think that it also, when you are starting to drill into, you know, responding to the budget guidance you get from the city, it's really about that general fund. So just thinking about how that enmeshes with what you're grappling with on the overall budget side, it kind of helps crystallize it a little bit, I think, in a way that sometimes when you're looking at the whole world of PHB programs and money, a lot of that is sort of set, and it's set for very particular programs.
Thank you, Sarah. That's very helpful. Mike, could you actually go back a couple slides just for our benefit to the big? Yeah, so I wanted to point out, just, you know, in speaking of this with Sarah, I think you will sometimes look at this and say, oh my gosh, the Bureau has
you know, $119 million to spend on rental development this year. And this is actually commitments to projects in the pipeline over a period of years. So there is not flexibility. These were decisions that were made sometimes 5 and 6 years ago to fund a project, and these happen to be our estimate of the cost of those development this particular year. Much of our funds are projected years out, and then obviously much of what we do in terms of actually funding developments are done through our notice of funds availability, so a competitive process of the Bureau. So there isn't a lot of interplay around. And when I talk about what programs we may want to speak with you about, they do tend to reside in some of the more renter services, fair housing areas. What would we like to emphasize this year, potentially with service dollars or other? You know, do we want to ask for a small amount of city general fund resources for a new program, or potentially an acquisition fund of some type? So, but just, you know, I think this does tend to confuse people, and they think, oh my gosh, you can fund $120 million this year. But in reality, this is all long-term commitments in one way or another.
Yeah, one of the challenges we have, and we're something we continue to refine every year, is working with the affordable rental housing team and trying to, again, it's a tightrope we kind of walk between, wanting to be very transparent with the public about this is everything that's committed, yet at the same time not creating the expectation that we're actually going to spend $119 million. Some of that's construction, as Shannon was saying, some of that is construction that's underway right now. River Place, for example, Block 45, you know, a lot of construction going on both those places that you can see. But there, this number, for example, actually has all the funds that are currently out in the 2018 NOFA. And so one of the things I'm doing in the fall supplemental is, now that we know the timing on that a little better, is moving those funds around more where they're actually going to spend. We're just trying to do a better job of that, but it's really difficult to try to provide that transparency that yes, that money is committed, and still deal with the reality that it's not going to get spent for a year or two.
Well, the rough analogy for me, I guess, is from a balance sheet, the distinction between restricted assets and unrestricted assets, and it's a rough analogy, but you know, Shannon's point brings up the other side of the coin for me, is it might be helpful to have a sense of where is our discretionary source as opposed to committed source. And I don't know if you array any of those that way, but as a budget person or a policy person, I would want to know. So you're right, Shannon, okay, that's great. So how much of the 119 is committed and how much can I play with? And so I think that leads me to that question about if there's any way to present to anybody what you really have to allocate, grapple with, as opposed to contracts that are either dry or almost dry.
Right. And one of the other issues we run into, I think a good example is if you look at the home ownership programs, what we're dealing with is contracts, and we're dealing with a lot of single family loans where the churn on that is annual, as opposed to, well, that's all locked up in a loan commitment we made 2 years ago.
Right.
But by the same token, you're still having to make the choice programmatically. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to make changes, right, that money's not committed today because those borrowers haven't locked in the door yet. But by the same token, if you make a decision, that money's not going to be there when those borrowers walk in the door. So that's a decision you're making, even though it's not technically committed. And I know that's been one of the challenges to try to communicate that, is that this is what we've got out there for home ownership, but
don't run and spend it.
right.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I'm really looking forward to having more open conversation about is this whole question of how to, you know, fund the continuum of housing needs across the board. We've talked a lot about this. And we certainly know and need to be reminded of what's been committed and what we can't really change at all. I mean, committed projects. Completely agree with Sarah's point. Would also add that there are choices within the CDBG world at the local level that can change emphasis or could be considered as different alternatives to what's been done. And that's part of that continuum question. What, where should we be putting the resources? And when I say we, I think it's crystal clear that whatever we say is purely advisory. You guys have to make the tough decision, and the mayor's going to make the decision in the end. It's not up to us. But just to have that open, thoughtful conversation, just to add, because a lot of what happens is you get in a world of just doing a process the same way over and over again, and there's a lot of other information out there that could be really, I hope what we can each bring, and I would love for us to have more participation on this commission so we can banter a little bit about these really fascinating questions about, you know, how do you apply the next available public resource to the most compelling need, and not just the next project or program somebody kind of cooked up that kind of sounds cool. I mean, not that that happens necessarily, but I've seen some project proposals that maybe not this bureau, but it can happen. So the other thing I would just add is I think there's just a really compelling argument for as much coordination with the other sources of funding that are out there. You know, the state is stepping up more, the LIFT funds, not just for our projects, but across the board, and aligning them. You might choose to emphasize a CDBG commitment because it matches that state commitment if the administrative rules all click into place. And then there's the Metro bond. You know, what's that going to mean to the city of Portland? And I know there's a limited amount, there's a lot of other jurisdictions, but how do we get the very best bang for that buck? Feds, Metro, state, in coordination with the county. I think, you know, I'm just very anxious to see us, you know, the city really hit a stride in all those areas. And it's complicated, it's just sophisticated work, but I'm looking forward to some of these conversations.
They call that alignment.
Alignment. That's right.
Alignment. Term of the realm.
Well, Mike, thank you very much for the early presentation, and the rest of the commission looks forward to continuing the conversation with you.
Welcome back.
Sure. I'll be here in January.
During public testimony.
Yeah, exactly.
3 minutes only.
I think that is it for today.
I guess I'm saying. So I missed the beginning of the meeting, apparently. Sorry, I was late.
He's denying.
So, right. Yeah, apparently. But I do want to say something about Sarah since it's her last meeting. Yeah. And she's going to have to sit there and listen. So, Ramsey, I've got something nice to say about the chair. So I think, and I don't know if someone said it this morning, but, you know, Sarah's been on PHEC for longer than I've been with the Bureau, and I've been fortunate to get to work with her a lot while she's chair. And I just wanted to say that I think that one of the things that probably a lot of staff and a lot of members don't see, which will be large shoes to fill, is her commitment that she's had to making sure that whether it's members of city council, the commissioner in charge, bureau staff at times, is really taking seriously the perspective of PHEC as a body and PHEC as individual members. And it is a lot of work. It's a lot of phone calls and a lot of meetings and a lot of, you know, sometimes not talking, Sarah and I not talking for a couple of weeks, and sometimes just talking multiple times a day over weeks. And so, you know, she has put a lot of time and a lot of energy into making sure that the commissioners sitting around the table, that their time is well spent, and that the fact that they're volunteering to give their perspective is taken seriously by the Bureau and the commissioner in charge and city council as a body. And so I just want to say personally thank you, but also I think just acknowledging, particularly for new members, that she has done quite a bit behind the scenes that no one really sees, except probably, you know, myself. I've seen it, and the other, well, Dyke and Elise are gone, so they saw it as well. So thank you, and there'll be big shoes to fill. So.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.